You're listening to a podcast from World Literature Festival 2014. This podcast features a reflective summary of the 2014 provocations by poet and translator George Surtees.
So, George.
The difficulty of the job is, as John says, to sort the essential from that which may not be essential or that which is illustrative of the essential. But it's not necessarily a key part of it. So you will forgive me if some parts of it will... I will have to miss some parts, and I will very much precede some parts, and you can correct me if I have mispreceded you. Now, what it seems to me is that we've had two essential kind of conditions being evoked. Nostalgia is our theme, but the background is remembering. So remembering as a public event and remembering as a private event, the relationship between these two kinds of remembering, and the point at which memory becomes nostalgia, however you define nostalgia. Parallel with this, and I think this has been the key dichotomy, if you like, between the positions and what kind of holds us together like a kind of glue, is the idea of, on the one hand, seeking after a kind of truth which is raw, authentic, and is difficult, and a struggle to avoid an easy version of it, in which meaning is not only drained from the memory, but is actually actively turned against it. So we are looking to fix our tightrope somewhere between these positions. Now, when I started thinking about this, this odd thought came into my mind that surely, there must be a perfume called nostalgia. And indeed, there is a perfume called nostalgia. It is for men. Let me give you a critical view. I've taken this directly from the internet. This is a review of nostalgia for men. I will give you another one after that. The rather aptly named nostalgia briefly made me feel like the racing legend Mario Andretti in a 1970s Alfa Romeo Spydeck convertible, or like the ultra-cool Steve McQueen in his Jaguar XKSS. Close your eyes and imagine a powerful old car on a racing track sat in a birchwood forest. The smell of diesel fuel is in the air, along with the cracked leather seats of the ancient vehicle and the smell of campfire smoke from a fire in the trees beyond. Bergamot swirls its sweet juices into the mix, along with vanilla, amber, and earthy patchouli. As you rev your engines and press your foot on the pedal, you speed away so fast that you leave behind the diesel fuel and enter into a vanilla amber cocoon nestled amidst the birch trees. There you take shelter in the haze of creamy, warm, lightly powdered vanillic sweetness infused with campfire smoke. It's a simple smell. But then nostalgia is a return to a simpler, more nostalgic time. I mean, one of the things that strikes me about that in passing is how detailed it actually is and how specific, you know. Mario Andretti, wow, that's just my time. I want to go there. And then you have the Jaguar XKSS. It's nothing if not specific. But there is, in fact, a perfume also for women, but it's called Nostalgie. And this is what it says about Nostalgie. Again, bear in mind, this is not advertising copy. This is a review. Do you recall the opening of Van Cleef & Arpels first? Everything denoting luxury, power, femininity, class and wealth was added into producing that powerhouse last of the MacAldehig clan, a fragrance as shimmery as the brightest yellow sapphires, as frothy as the sparkliest bubbly in iced flute, as melodious as Jenny Vanu singing Dawn's minor key. I was instantly transported in those times, back when first precious metal wasn't somewhat tarnished, the good old days, down to reformulations upon testing nostalgia. I mean, it is nostalgia we understand from this. What it means to the producers of perfumes is a set of associations. but they're quite specific associations which take us to reasonably specific places in the imagination. We have to remember Steve McQueen, you should remember Mario Andretti. Real memory is being called for. Now, my grand plan, so far as I can execute it, is to go through the various provocations a little bit and to touch lightly upon some of the comments. And it struck me that it's not a great step, actually, from the idea of perfume to the idea of bromide. Perfume is there to heighten desire. Bromide was supposed to be, I think, at the time of the First World War, to suppress desire. Nevertheless, it does all the things that Denise said it did. Now, John's, before we started, suggested that nostalgia may fulfill a narrative desire for an imaginative return to some former state, and we had Odysseus returning to Ithaca. There was a peculiarly modern thing, a modern sensibility, and even instance Schiller, but the poet is opposing civilization to nature, or some idea of nature. And then we had the interesting idea of Seamus Heaney writing about Derek Mahon. Derek Mahon is somebody who's nostalgic for a place he wanted to get out of in the first place, or at least what he is writing is a form of nostalgia for it. Denise wondered whether nostalgia was not a bromide to weaken the whole system of resistance. Something she compared to, nicely, an oily paste, the consumption of which condemned the indulger to a series of false closures or endless beginnings. She explained it was a 19th century sedative. Its bromide-like purpose, she argued, is to weaken resistance to a true sense of the past and to obscure more thorough, more honest engagement with truth. It's what I was talking about when I think about the raw and the painful and the hurtful. Why is it so prevalent today? Term she suggested was nostalgia, she suggested, is one of a group of diluted similar terms such as trauma or irony. These are words which have come into kind of general use and which stand as shorthand for things that we're not absolutely sure of. And she mentioned this nostalgia critic on YouTube who was offering to remember the past for you. She talked of John Major conjuring these nostalgic images of England, even if only to assure people who were afraid of Europe that certain things there would always be in England, in other words. Right, so we've got onto a discussion, and Jalou was saying, and in fact, in her own publication, she was partly continuing to say whether this was not too Western a reading of the term. And she was recalling that Maoist rhetoric attacked nostalgia because it actually helped people to remember a pre-Mao past. So here you have a kind of an interesting first opposition between nostalgia as a kind of false comfort and then nostalgia as a way of resisting the suppression of the past. Kathy Cole really interestingly pointed to Vietnamese students who are now nostalgic for the Vietnamese War. But that is to say, the experience has actually moved on to another level. It is now beyond direct pain experience. It is now part of a story, part of a myth that people associate with it. Louise Doughty, I think, was a very nice thing, and also a key idea. When she's, she conjured up Edward Thomas, and when he was asked, what are you fighting for? He grabbed hold of a handful of soil and said this. Another sort of interesting dichotomy that was opened up in the course of that first discussion was whether we can actually separate history and desire. Adam Folds pointed to a distinction, A, between one sort of nostalgia, which is used in a false political sort of way, and nostalgia, as I think I've quoted right, as an aspect of desire that has no object, or as I would put it actually, the desire with a shifting object. I think there's always an object, it just keeps shifting. He noted Christianity's nostalgia for unification with God. Bernice went back essentially to Charlie's point about the repression of nostalgia. The repression of nostalgia as an aspect of the desire to actually belong to your past, and I think her presentation was an aspect of that. And there were a number of other interesting sort of comments that sort of opened up territories which had already been touched on, so I shall leave that for now. I'll move on to Owen. Owen moved our attention to the military sphere. He began by tracing the word back to its origins, and he was tracing it back, I think, to the 17th. There was some doubt whether it was 17th or 18th century, but we all agreed on Swiss soldiers, I think. Swiss soldiers and war and absence and cowbells and things like that. He also pointed us to the roots of the word in Greek, which is nostos, meaning home, and algos, meaning pain. So to some degree, which I'd like to come back to right at the end, the idea of homeache is like stomach ache or like heartache or like any other kind of ache. Now, his theme, essentially, I'm going to sort of, again, and you can correct me anytime if you think I've misunderstood you or preceded you in a disfiguring sort of way. And here I'm pressing my own writing because I want to be moving on. That the nostalgia that soldiers felt, and these were two key points, were not nostalgia for home, because they actually wanted to get away from home. The nostalgia that soldiers might feel, if you want to call it nostalgia, is actually for the scene of battle. And that scene of battle is associated with love, because it is during battle, which is the whole, if you like, point of of being part of a military, is the attachment to your comrades. And the intense attachment you feel for them, but also the very intense hatred that you then feel for those who have killed them. So for these young soldiers, it is the most intense experience of their lives, and of course they feel somewhat lost after this. The first response to this, as far as I remember, was a certain degree of pity and alarm. Why do these young men feel so? Why should young men feel so? Is this just a purely young male kind of condition? And if so, is there anything that should be done about it? Were these young men being manipulated in a distressing sort of fashion? It seems such an unhealthy object of nostalgia. Jonty, I think, then reminded us that in Tennyson, Ulysses can't wait to leave home as well. James wondered whether military language was a home. So the idea of love, I think Cunha talked about the idea of love as being energizing, and that somehow these soldiers, through whatever their interpretation of feeling of love, were being energized. The word experience of war being in itself so emotive, it was not surprising we were drawn a little away from notions of nostalgia to focus on the experiences of war. It did, however, I think, succeed in raising questions about the idea of home as the object of nostalgia. It wasn't necessarily homesickness for the land in Edward Thomas's hand, but for an intensity of an experience that defined you, an experience that was associated with love, which might be to do with home, but is not necessarily home. It's interesting, I can't cover the translation thing very much because it's yet another session, but it was a very interesting session. But because nostalgia reappeared, although indirect in a kind of ghost form, in the form of language as a sort of matrix, that might offer a similar sense of home, actually picking up on something that was actually said in Owen's session. And what happens when we shift from one language to another? Wonderful images there, the idea of transplanting trees. And of course, I will never actually forget looking at and listening to Dai talking about that interlineated translation of the first part of Finnegan's Wake. Suddenly, that made everything so fresh and playful, and it took the load off us a little bit, in a way that Jalou, I think, was sort of doing, being very serious, but at the same time, it was such a miracle in itself. But then we had a really provocative provocation, thanks to Wojciech. He basically challenged the wealthy coziness, not only of the term nostalgia, but of fiction itself, of the imagination. Now, being a writer of committed reportage, he led us through the doors of a school in the Rwanda massacre, showed us the corpses in great detail. All the words in existence are already worn out, he said, quoting. What words, after all, could there be for the Bosnian woman he mentioned waiting for the disinterring of her lost menfolk's bones so that she could reconstruct them? Under these conditions, nostalgia was an occupation for safe and rich people, such as ourselves. By the door of the school in Rwanda stands the woman Juliet, a Hutu, and therefore safe from the Hutu set on massacring the Tutsis, but with a Tutsi husband, and therefore with Tutsi children. Juliet, he said, and this is the part that really struck me. Juliet, he said, invites you in. Juliet shows you everything. Why bother with non-fiction under those circumstances? Fiction is the implication, is the opposite of reality under certain circumstances. So the question was whether then the writing could be instrumental in stopping killing. So how instrumental should writing be? This naturally brought in the role of the writer in society, responsibility, obligation, whatever you want. The initial shockwave, because it was, after all, it's a form of accusation as provocation, and very good at that, was, since we were mostly fiction writers, bound to lead to defences of fiction and to the defence of the imagination. Kendall suggested that social action might be more effective in theatrical form than in novels. Louise Doughty argued that one of the strengths of fiction is that it could not be gainsaid or proved false, whereas documents can. You can have different versions of the same event. How far can a reporter of a story such as Rwanda trust himself was a question. Wojciech's honest answer was one has to both trust and distrust oneself. My own little doubt was about the value of Juliet's existence as other than the figure at that door. And since I began this with a reference to perfumes, I now wonder what perfume Juliet might have chosen before the massacre, and that before that time. How did she choose her clothes, her hair, her ornaments, those parts of her life that defied her before the massacre? Was she doomed to stand at that door forever? Is that what she was? It's my argument, if you like, for the what may appear trivial under the circumstances. Hannah was arguing for the text as text, and not really for this distinction between fiction, non-fiction, and so on, to which Wojciech answered that in the case of Juliet, in the context of Rwanda, text can't be regarded just as text, that there's something important beyond. We then had a brief sally on voyeurism. Are we voyeurs being shown around by Juliet, or indeed by the reporter? And my own feeling about this is that voyeurism is one of those bad words that is supposed to frighten us, that's supposed to censor, I think, a perfectly normal instinct. Now, literature would probably be nothing without voyeurism. We are always watching other people doing things. So in many ways, we are back on Denise's ground, I think, except that nostalgia here is not simply a bad political device, but an aspect of imaginative fiction in general, especially when having to face the dreadful truths of actual life and death in a world that, as Wojciech says, is continually at war, not just in the past, but in the present. After this very powerful and very visceral provocation, James's defense of nostalgia, or rather redefinition of it in terms of bookishness, childhood, and the realm of the imagination. He recalled his own childhood regularly on the move and his childhood reading. Books, he said, are portable, and all his early favourite characters were, in fact, like him, people who lived by books. He reminded us of Alain Fournier's Le Grand Monde, with its enchanted narrator, François Sorel, of the Great Gatsby, and of what he generally called the Doomed Fantasists Club, which is a lovely phrase, and the realisation that through literature we can, quote, recall experiences we have never had. He led us to Don Quixote, where truth and illusion share the same space, where Quixote is undone by books. He went on to Madame Bovary, how she too is sort of undone by books, and it might have done her good to get out more and to not to be too contemptuous of where she was actually living. James suggested that this bookish realm was a way of missing things by inventing them. And I think that's another really important sort of question, which I'll cover when we get to Kerry. We create invisible cities where time and space contract. You had the Borges story, and you were quoting Marquez to the effect that what matters is not what happens, but what we remember. And then recounted the way you were breaking into these derelict asylums with their graffiti and ill notices, and that nostalgia takes us not just to Tintin Abbey, but also to Chernobyl. John Coetzee picked up on the word whimsy, and we argue about that a little. Dai told us of the nostalgia for family in China, family rather than the past, since the past was a constant present, though it had been blotted out by the Cultural Revolution. So culturally, the notion of a past had a different status to what it does enjoys with us. Owen, on the other hand, talk of the Welsh Hirach, am I pronouncing it right? Okay, not too bad. That goes back to 1282, I remember the date, and the longing for the Welsh past, and reminds us how powerful it is, and how that kind of thought actually keeps a sporting team going. It's a cause, it's a drive. Hannah took the conversation to love and the attachment to mother figure. We never really explored this, but it would have been very, very interesting. Since we talk of motherland, not everybody did. There are people who talked of fatherland, of course, and mother tongues. So we have this idea of being nostalgic for what is genuinely lost, and also, as Danny mentioned, the Portuguese idea of saudade, the melancholy longing for a missing something. These little balances keep coming back. We keep coming back to them. Third session, led by Akhil. Fascinating session. Very finely woven, kind of now open, now closed sort of essay, which led us into complex psychological territories involving shame, guilt, the pleasures of sadness, the nature of irony, and our relation to the past. And he began with his personal story about a relationship in which his attachment to sadness led to the breakup of a relationship. Sadness, he suggested, was a seeking for security. Happiness, he said, leads to anxiety. And he took us through the implications of various literary devices, such as writing in the first person, writing in the present tense, because the past, he said, was, nice phrase, soaked in nostalgia and beautiful language. Beautiful language, he said, was also an aspect of the émigré writer's use of exoticism, if only because the émigré is expected to be exotic. Exoticism offers us lushness of detail, but also a certain danger of stereotyping. He also talked about audience as a presence. An Indian in the USA writing about India writes differently from one who writes for Indians at home is part of his case. That was, I think, also echoed to some degree by Sijoy. People at home need less description. So maybe detail in itself, just detail, was to be treated with some suspicion. And John Kotzier asked about the fetishization of detail. And he was concerned about the assumptions we may be making about an audience. How far do we know an audience? Does detail have to be exotic? James picked up on the idea of fondling of detail and suggested that nice paradox that nostalgia is perceived to be fuzzy, but detail is not. And that takes me back to my perfume, just how unfuzzy that was actually. I think here, in answering Akhil said that he writes for other writers, those he particularly admires. This would be my own usual answer, by the way. Adam referred us to Nabokov's injunction to fondle detail, to allow for auto-exoticism. Denise then made this dramatic and very effective intervention, saying, I am the woman. I am the very woman you are talking about. And then whether, this is the way I understood it, I'm not sure if I understood it absolutely correctly, but I felt there was an implication that the desire for sadness, which can be honestly admitted, then becomes the context within which the other person is, then has their existence. So instead of them being them, they are the object of sadness. So the object of some kind of ready feeling which we enjoy. So they're actually being exploited in some way. Adam took us into camera lucida, and this is a wonderful thing. This is the rescue of detail, where Bart, in his marvelous book, he talks about the punctum, as that very detail which takes you beyond the general, what he calls a studium, in order precisely to get to that raw truth, which the studium would not allow you to, because you already know too much about it. You know what you want. You know what you're expecting. Oh, I love this, you know, this is a Barth argument. I love this picture of giraffes because I love giraffes. There was a consideration of, Chris considered Zabel's melancholy, Thomas Brown's Urban Burial, these are all very local things, as possible examples of nostalgia. And it reminded us how much reading differs according to the context that you're given. for what you're reading. So again, the expected as against the raw. Kathy suggested nostalgia might be a way of recovering details of childhood, etc. And I've gone to Kerry's, which I thought was actually fascinating and kind of crucial in some sort of ways. She was basically recounting her own history in the writing of her books. Is that my timer? You have 30 seconds. She talked of how, as an immigrant, she felt a fear of feeling anything. She talked of colonialism and racism, her coming to England as a child, living here most of her life. And then she talked, I think, really fascinatingly and interestingly about both the reality and the invention of Jamaica, her object of, let's call it nostalgia for now, because that's the term we're using, it's her object of desire, in which she offers, as a gift, by dedication of the book to her father, mother, and the country itself, what she has written, she says, is a history of Jamaica that is true to the people for whom it is written. And that contains great complexities. The reality she offers to those people is one that is both researched and invented from the outside, from a position of exile, but the people take great delight in it. Uni asks whether it is possible to identify with a people or one's idea of the people without a sense of what you call national identity. Is part of being settled in England, I think she was saying this, I'm scribbling things down very, very fast as people are speaking, is part of being settled in England the ability to imagine England? But is identity, this is my note, but is identity more of a struggle for the outsider than the insider? We did raise this. Masatsuko Ono tells us of books by foreign writers living in Japan who write about their countries of origin. But when they write about Japan, it is less interesting for the Japanese because, well, we already know Japan. This partly relates also to Akhil's sense of the exoticization, but also to Kerry's idea of inventing Jamaica and offering it as a gift. Bessua said she had no sense of exile herself. Exile, as far as understood it, was associated with destiny. Writers exiled themselves. Was rejection of identity, she said, a postmodern phenomenon? So we don't actually want it. We don't necessarily want to be identified. And Chris recounted that you sometimes feel a stranger in your own country. Kerry concluded that her identity was not a problem for her. She was, despite all her time in England, a Jamaican. But on the other hand, she would not wish to be identified in any way that defined her, i.e., one has the wish to define oneself. So, the question remains, who identifies who? What do we invent? And what do we offer to the very people we have invented? What is being invented? Invention, too, is an aspect of nostalgia, possibly, a nostalgia for what needs to be invented. But if there are two distinct realms of truth and reality on the one hand, and I think of Denise's and Wojciech's strictures and provocations, and of falsity, invention, detail, and imagination on the other, which realm does Kerry's passionate but invented Jamaica inhabit? Is it the true or the nostalgic? Do we make these distinctions? How do we make them? Are there conditions under which invention and truth can coexist? And is that condition called art? I'll just say a couple of things about today, but I'm more or less reached an end. I want to finish with something, a few things I scribbled myself. It is a very interesting listening to Denise, because clearly what she's writing about is a situation that obtains, that goes on. So in a way, it is part of the active field. In a way, it is doing what Richelieu is asking for. It is in the public realm. It is possibly in a public square, and it possibly is instrumental in achieving something. And yet it is drawn almost entirely from the family, from revival of the family, and not so much, and insofar as the family is a container for the past. So the past is contained within the family, rather than, if you like, the past contains the family. And there are two different ways of going about it. I'm kind of almost at an end, and because I mean, you've already just heard Charlize, and I don't know, and I loved it. It's just nice and it is fresh. And it raises, and I was talking about it with Owen just before, our notion of what it means to be an intellectual in England. Are you simply a matter of the chattering classes? Do you feel any authority in delivering yourself of an opinion? On what forum do you deliver yourself of this opinion? And if you did deliver yourself of this opinion, what would you then be? So what is the nature of public authority as far as writers go? Okay, this is what I finish with. And it's my sort of little indulgence, but I do it some years, which is, I Twitter quite a lot. You know, this is just one of my many frivolities. I was very glad to discover that there's a school in Hungary, there's a great Hungarian writer called Antal Serb, who in the 1930s belonged to a school called the Neo-Frivolity. Well, this is partly frivolity. I've renamed nostalgia homemake, as I said I would, just like every other ache you ever get. So each of these is a little tweet. Each of them is under 140 characters. Homemake, the soldier with his distances, the liar with his indulgences, the noise of deserted streets, open mouth. You hold the homemake in your hand as if it were yours, as if your hands were yours, as if you had hands, as if you had a home. You feel unjustified. You don't recognize the madness in your veins. The aching in your arms is for a home beyond arm's length. Homemake is a city suddenly empty, a familiar, unidentified smell. The self goes missing, finding itself unmoored, a shower of faint stars. I can no longer count its streets, says a voice you recognize. These are your streets. There are too many to count. They are yours to lose. How many ways of recognizing home without inhabiting it, without ever having inhabited it? Who lives there now? Whose eyes meet its people? After the rain, the dry street. In the dead of night, a sound settling into life. That too is an ache seeking a home. Then the sound of rain. It's like ringing a bell at night. No one hears it, not even the bell ringer. No, not even you. Yet it's there because you recognize it. Homemake can't perfect itself. It can't even move. It makes sculptures out of absence. It is its own lost art. Homemake, the fierce wind wrapping itself around trees and eaves. The consolations of being consoled, of being able to conceive of consolation, of a home to ache for, of phantom limbs. How many ways of making the beautiful out of lack? Why desire the beautiful? Would home be beautiful? Would it ache? Would it desire? You have arrived home. You take off your coat. You move down the hall. Your body aches. The ache becomes your home. You close the door. I just want to finish up last with a memory of John Carey, who I think gave a lovely, lovely interview. And John Carey's brief poem in praise of doubt, with which my heart is fully in resonance, that what we gain in knowledge is what we doubt, rather than what we think we know. It comes down to the hatred of certainties, but these are the, if you like, that's the tightrope. That's the tightrope we're on. And the higher the tightrope, the more interesting and the more exciting. So that's it.
World Literature Festival is run by Writer Centre Norwich. For more information on the centre, visit writercentrenorwich.org.uk.